girls, this is the last class in the series about popular culture in Britain since 1945. And I'm going to continue what I was doing last week, which is to look, because during the semester I've been looking at cinema, television, popular music, visual arts, and looking a little bit at how the changes in society leave their traces in cultural production, and also introducing you, I hope, to some cinema and some popular music you didn't know. And today I want to look more at different ways of analysing culture, different ways of understanding culture, theory about culture. Now, this is just an introduction. If you get interested in this and you work on it at master level, you'll be reading big books like this about it. But this is just an introduction. Some of the most important thinkers and some of the most important ways of looking at popular culture, because of course in a university 50 years ago, if a professor said, "I want to give a class on popular culture," his colleagues would say, no, there's nothing interesting about popular culture. There's nothing complicated about it. There's nothing complex about it. It's not worth studying. And that has changed. Now, I began last week by introducing you to this gentleman, Theodor Adorno, who is very important because he was one of the first thinkers who said that we need to understand popular culture. That was what was new about him. Now, as you remember, he didn't like it very much. So in many ways, he was very negative about it. But nevertheless, he took it seriously. He said, we need to understand it. And so that's why most people who have thought about popular culture since have started from what Adorno was saying. And I gave you some of this stuff, and I'm going to continue from here. Adorno came up with the idea of the culture industry. See, so the culture industry, so industry, of course, fabricates products, and the main aim of actors in industry, of course, is to make profit. That's how the world works. And so for Adorno, the culture industry was just the same as the furniture industry, as the clothes industry. There was nothing really special about it, that this was Adorno's thing. And in particular, notice he talks about the culture industry. Not the many different culture companies who all have a slightly different aim and maybe sometimes are in conflict. No, it's a sort of monolithic culture industry. And this is one of the things he says about it. The culture industry fuses the old and familiar into a new quality. Yeah. So you're buying new Coca-Cola Green, what is called Coca-Cola Life. Yeah, and it appears to be new, but really it's not so new. And he considered this also to be the case for music, cinema, television, and so on. In all its branches and products, which are tailored for consumption by masses, and which to a great extent determine the nature of that consumption, are manufactured more or less according to plan. In all its branches, products which are tailored for consumption by masses and which to a great extent determine the nature of that consumption are manufactured more or less according to plan. So this is the idea that the record companies decide, they decide what you are going to like next year. This is what it's not my opinion, it's his opinion. Yeah. So you have heard this idea around. Yes, we often imagine that some aspects of popular cultural consumption, buying things, is we're being brainwashed. I'm not saying it's true. That's an idea more or less according to plan. Okay. And this is another quotation from Adorno along the same lines. And although maybe you'd never heard of Adorno, I'm sure you've heard of ideas like this. People know what they want, he said, because they know what other people want. Yes, I'm sure you have little brothers and sisters who want the toy for Christmas because all their friends have one, or they tell you that all their friends have one. This is this kind of idea here. It posits the idea that cultural consumption is passive, manipulated, and so on and so forth. And I think it's fair to say there is obviously some truth in this, but how much? That's the question. Sam, how much? Of course, it's very easy to solve this. Everything you like is because you're brainwashed. But everything I like is because it's good. It's a simple question, a simple thing to organize there. He also, Adorno suggests psychological effects and bases for cultural consumption. When you're watching television programs or cinema, according to Adorno, this is how he describes the process. The culture industry, he says, does not sublimate, it represses. Now, sublimation, this is an old idea around art. It's the idea that, well, that Freud in particular spoke about. He said that human beings are fundamentally driven by sex. And art and beauty and other creative aspects are sublimations of an animal instinct. So because we are human beings and we are higher, we are not obliged to be only interested in the animal. We can sublimate and produce beautiful poetry or music out of the animal instincts. That's a Freudian idea. But Adorno comes back on this and he says that the culture industry does not make you higher, from make you use your instincts in a higher way. On the contrary, it represses them by repeating. I continue, by repeatedly exposing the objects of desire, breasts in a clinging sweater, or the naked torso of the athletic hero. Calm down. It only sublimates the unsublimated for pleasure, which habitual deprivation has long since reduced to masochistic semblance. Don't worry about the exact details of that rather complicated sentence, but it's the idea that it is not good for you. This is Adorno saying, if you watch your favourite television and horror movies or whatever, he says it's not sublimating, it's just repressing you. It's causing you, in a way, psychological damage. And he continues, he writes quite a lot on pop music. Now, at the time, he wrote about what he called jazz. This is like swing at the time, for the big bands which were around at the time when he wrote. And he has, a very negative view. It's going to get more positive in a moment when we leave Adorno behind. But for Adorno, it's all very negative. So what does he say about popular music? Some of its principal characteristics are unabating repetition of some particular musical formula, comparable to the attitude of a child incessantly uttering the same demand. I want a biscuit, I want a biscuit, I want a biscuit, I want a biscuit, yeah? Or as Adorno says here, I want to be happy. So he's been very critical about the content of popular music, saying it's very repetitive, it's very childish, it makes us into children. The limitation of many melodies to very few tones, comparable to the way in which a small child speaks before he has the full alphabet at his disposal. Treating adults like children is involved in that representation of fun, which is aimed at relieving the strain of their adult responsibilities. So in the opinion of Adorno again, what does popular music do? It treats adults like children. Vous avez bien compris, si vous voulez sortir en boîte, il ne faut pas l'inviter, ce gars. C'est pas la peine, il ne va pas s'amuser. Okay, so this is a sophisticated theory, and it deserves discussion, we'll come on to a little more. Just one more example about dancing. I'm going to put this PowerPoint up on the blog. About dancing, you have this is 1930s. This is the 1930s, of course, this is the jitterbug. This is sort of rock and roll sort of dancing, which was already old-fashioned when I was your age, so it must seem like prehistoric to you. The jitterbug. And notice that the name, the jitterbug, it's a kind of insect. It's a kind of insect that jumps around a lot. And this was an extremely popular dance, and you can imagine it being a craze, you know, before Gangnam Style, yeah, that kind of thing that, you know, everybody likes. And as you can imagine, Adorno was not very impressed. And this is what Adorno said about it, I hope. Please. On Music for Dancing, or again in this big book, Essays on Music, which is quite difficult. I've chosen some of the easier quotations. in order to become a jitterbug, like these people, or simply to like popular music, it does not by any means suffice to give oneself up and to fall in line passively. So if you want to like popular music or dance like that, it's not enough to be passive. To become transformed into an insect, the jitterbug, man needs that energy which might possibly achieve his transformation into a man. So this is a very aggressive and violent description of the thing. He says that you are, when you get involved in singing and dancing with popular music, you are using the energy which you should be using for something else, according to Adorno. You should be using it in order to become fully human. And in fact, you prefer to become insects. You can see it's not, it's pretty... hard thing. It has the advantage of clarity. Yeah, it has the merit of clearly explaining his position. So let's see what we can come to that. Just the last one of Adorno, and then I will talk about some of the replies which have made to Adorno. And it's what he talks about, again coming back to music, he talks about regressive listening. Regressive is a psychological term. Again, it's becoming a child. Becoming a child again, becoming primitive. And so losing the sophistication, intelligence and effect, which is is what we've learned to have at adults. The commodity system of music, he says, requires regressive, that is childish listeners. Their, or our, primitivism is not that of the undeveloped, but of the forcibly retarded. Whenever they have a chance, they display the pinched hatred of those who really sense the other, but exclude it in order to live in peace. So there's something interesting in this quotation, is that he does say, they're our primitivism. So he admits that he himself is also sometimes pulled into this desire to become a child again. And he's talking about, well, at the time he was talking about the jitterbug, but you can imagine in a nightclub with loud music all night long, there is something very it's very different from everyday life. There's a certain sort of irrational side to it, a certain mantra or sort of bodily rhythm involved. Okay, so there he is. And so, if I was to simplify a little bit, I found this on the... here is a simplistic representation of Adorno's position. Yeah, you can see the media just spoon-feeding. And I'm sure you have seen ideas like this. Yeah, I see them on Facebook all the time. Yeah, people who say, oh, yeah, we're all being manipulated. Or, you're being manipulated. And that there's nothing valuable in the media... television or cinema and so on. Although sometimes people say, in general, popular culture is manipulating people, but not mine, not the bit I like. Okay, so let's see how people came back on this, what kind of replies were given to Adorno. Well, the first thing to notice that is, if Adorno was right, then really nothing happens in popular culture. That is to say that the culture industry decides what will be popular, and every now and then they change so that they can sell more, but it doesn't. Nothing really happens. Yeah. So if you see here, here are a series of chunks of popular culture which have been popular over the last 20 years. You've got the television series like Sherlock. Any Sherlock fans? Yeah, a lot of Sherlock fans. Okay, any Downton Abbey fans? Even more, my God. Okay, so then Star Wars. Yeah, I'm a Star Wars fan. Any 21 Pilots fans? Oh yes, good. Yeah, I must admit I had to ask advice from my daughter as to who to put up here. Yes, and I discovered 21 Pilots. Sad Smith, the Rolling Stones are a group of old men who sing. Yeah, you got, you know that. Yeah, okay. So now I think, of course, it's fairly understandable for any of us to be sometimes critical of some aspects of popular culture, but the idea that there is nothing there, it's a very extreme idea. It seems to me that in the enjoyments and the ideas which are pushed around in these, that something is happening. That if you take the Rolling Stones and Sam Smith, it seems to me that you can see them as coming out of different periods and with different demands, in a way, where the Rolling Stones was very daring. The Rolling Stones today are not daring because the subjects they sing about now are not shocking. But when they began, they were singing about what was at the time was shocking. Wallace and Gromit. Any Wallace and Gromit fans? Oh, a few. Good. I've got a good thing. And the novels and so on. Yeah, this was just to really give a very wide brief. As we will see, the people who disagreed with Adorno but agreed to take popular culture seriously are interested in studying these elements. Then, you know, why does it rise? What does Sherlock show about the audience and the society that it was produced in? What is different about Sherlock than a similar Sherlock Holmes series produced 50 years ago? And more interesting, why is it different? Yeah, how has the audience changed? Expectations, television codes, moral questions, and so on and so forth. So these are some of the things they will take seriously. And here's some more. You have here then other aspects of popular culture magazines on the bottom, Men's Health and Yours, comics at the top, either the Beano. You know, the Beano is a children's comic, extremely popular in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and I think it died in the 90s. I think it died in the 90s. Maybe it didn't completely die. The people who are interested in cultural studies will say all of this can be studied. There are things to study in here. Obviously, you know, what Men's Health, very interesting. I dislike it, but it's very interesting because 50 years ago you couldn't produce Men's Health because being interested in your own health was not manly, was not masculine. Yeah, nobody would admit that they were interested. Yeah, and now Men's Health—I mean, that's still a little bit, unusual. But you can see all this, you know, the fat burning exercise, how to build muscle twice as fast. Yeah, even faster. Yes, I must do this. 57 success secrets from the world's fitness. But I always think that's really amusing because I would be interested in 3 fitness secrets, but 57. I mean, I'm tired just looking at the front page, you know. And also other aspects, because if you look at the top right and the bottom left, you get especially at the top right, you get some very popular magazines, but in fact, much more intellectual than popular magazines 50 years ago. This weekend in Paris, I was at the newly refurbished Musée de l'Homme, and it's full of people, thousands and thousands of people every day. But it's something which you would normally consider to be quite intellectual. It's very well done, incidentally. So there's all this with the rise of university education for ordinary people. Popular culture also has to take that into account. Okay, so let's have a look then at some of the objections that were made to Adorno's analyses, in particular of popular music. And first of all, I have here a quote from Martin Clunan. Martin Clunan is a Scottish, I think he's Scottish, intellectual who wrote a series of books about understanding popular music. His big objection to Adorno and Adorno's followers, because it's not just Adorno, Adorno's followers, he says, well, your problem is you don't actually study popular music. You say, in general, what popular music is like, but you don't actually study particular popular music in particular countries, in particular decades, so really you're being philosophical, but you're not being scientific. And so this is one of the big objections to Adorno and his friends, is empirical studies do not support his views. And here we have the quotation. The idea of the industry foisting rubbish, more or less at will, on a totally passive audience is facile. Facile, that means it's stupid, really. It's just a more intellectual word, yeah. If the industry could do so, it would, but it cannot. Most records are not hits. And in fact, I saw a study that said that a big record company, when they sign new singers, only 12% of the singers make money for the record company. But of course, they don't know which 12% are going to make money, and some of them make a lot of money, so it's okay. But the industry doesn't know what you will like next year. Most records are not hits. The industry is notoriously slow in picking up on crazes, and audiences soon tire of artists who are hyped into the charts. That is to say that if you have France un incroyable talent behind you, and that you get your first record, that will get you to sell your first record, but it won't sell your second record. And we have many examples to show this. Yeah, that. So Martin Clunin says the first objection is that if you look in detail at real popular music, what Adorno says is not true. The industry does not choose. And you hear this from time to time. I mean, I'm sure you all, well, maybe you don't, maybe it's just university professors who say things like that. But you say, oh, it's very easy to write a pop music song. Anybody can write one. Now, anybody who says this to you who is not a millionaire is a lawyer, because if they could have written a hit song instead of talking to you about it. The second very important objection is when you looked at when you heard Adorno talking about the jitterbug. Well, and about listening and repetition. And if you read other things that he writes, you find very clearly that Adorno only considers reflexive listening to be valuable. You know, where you sit still and you don't move and you listen to Beethoven, which is good, But for Adorno, this is the only valuable way of consuming culture. So if you're dancing the jitterbug, or whatever the modern equivalent is, no, I don't know either. Okay, right. Then if you're, that is to say, if you're not simply receiving it intellectually, but your body is involved, because, you know, if you are, any fans of techno music here? Techno fans? No techno fans. Heavy metal. Couple of heavy metal. Yeah, there's obviously something very bodily and physical, the volume and so on. You know, it's very difficult to sit down in your living room and put, not too loud, just a little bit of heavy metal music in and think about it. You know, that's not the invention. And Adorno considers only reflexive listening to be valuable, but this is a culture-bound judgment. He came from the respectable middle classes who listened to classical music, and so he imagined this is the only valuable thing you can do. Whereas in fact, of course, you can do dancing, karaoke, playing brass bands, any kind of thing. Third objection, we're still on the objections to Adorno's idea. The third big objection was, if Adorno was right, then changes in popular music would never accompany real changes in society. I remember reading one of the things Adorno said, and he said the difference between one music record and another music record is like when you have two bottles of tomato ketchup and this one has a nice yellow label so that you will buy it because it's pretty. Yeah, that there is no, for Adorno, there's no real difference between different kinds of music. And the problem with that is that means that popular music is taken out of history. Whereas Adorno was originally a Marxist. Marxists normally say that everything is in history. Everything is rooted to history. Everything changes. Nothing stays the same. Perhaps you heard the quote from Karl Marx, all that is solid melts into air. Yeah. Everything which is solid melts into the air. That's modern society. That's what society does. It makes things which appear that they will be forever, like the Soviet Union or heterosexual marriage, and then suddenly they're all melting into air. So I give some examples here, punk and rap. Now, it's not easy to explain in any detail what social changes make punk happen and what social changes are encouraged by punk. That's very complicated, but it seems clear to me anyway that punk was impossible without the economic and social crisis of the 1970s. In the 1950s, you get a new song, you know, no future, it's impossible to sell it because there's no unemployment. Everybody is much richer than their parents, you know, no future, it's not going to work. And of course, rap is a similar thing. It seems fairly, I know more about Britain than France, but the rise in interest and popularity of rap goes along with the rise of young, the growing up of young black people who were born in England and who want to be more active culturally and also want to integrate a cultural scene. In the 1960s in Britain, young people from Indian families or Caribbean families, they had cassette tapes, and they listened to them together and had little clubs, but it was very marginalised. And rap was one of the ways of making public aspects of black culture, and to say that, you know, hey, we're here. This is our home too. And of course, the moment of glory for that was the 2012 Olympic Games in London, when Dizzy Rascal, the rapper, is the official singer to open the Olympic Games. You know, which is the top. You know, if you're a singer, if you open the Olympic Games, you're doing really well. That's pretty good. You know. And the final objection to Adorno's ideas and his friends is that he supposes a monumental quantity of false consciousness. Now what's false consciousness? False consciousness is originally a sort of Marxist kind of idea. It's when people do not understand that they are being dominated. Yeah, that you can imagine a situation a long time ago where some slaves were so brainwashed by the system that said, oh, well, you know, it's okay. But it wasn't okay, but it just felt okay. And this is a little bit of a problem with Adorno, that because, of course, popular music and television are popular among hundreds of millions of people, then Adorno's position is, well, I understand, and these hundreds of millions of people haven't understood. And that, you know, of course, it's not impossible, but that's a little bit doubtful. So those are our major objections to Adorno's analysis, that empirical studies do not support his views, that he only considers one kind of listening, and there is no reason to consider only one kind of listening, that he takes popular music and popular culture in general out of history, and that he supposes a monumental quantity of false consciousness. And here's the results, which it was actually said by a French writer, Ludovic Tournez, in his book Reproduire l'œuvre, la nouvelle économie musicale. But I translated it into English because it's an English class. The result is that Adorno's theories are regarded today as largely obsolete and unscientific in the eyes of the cultural historian, who is preoccupied with understanding both systems of production and the development of the symbolic landscape of a given society. That is to say, the idea of brainwashed masses and monolithic cultural industries does not help us to understand the 1930s or the 1970s or the 2015s. Okay, so Adorno was writing originally in the 1930s and the 1950s, and so he was the grandfather, despite himself, he was the grandfather of cultural studies. And it's in the 60s that in Britain the idea of studying popular culture begins to come into its own. And cultural studies takes on then this idea of culture as an object of study. The subject area is not clearly defined. I talked about this a few weeks ago. A very wide idea of what is culture. Yeah, the culture is also men's health, is culture, and recherche appartement, is also culture. Remember, the question is not whether you like it or not, but that it is structured in a way which is linked to the lives, dreams, plans, thoughts and fantasies of the general population. Cultural studies uses principles and theories from social sciences disciplines and the humanities and the arts, and uses a very wide variety of methodologies, analysing texts, analysing groups of people, analysing psychology and so on. So you can imagine that if you were studying men's magazines and women's magazines, you could use some ideas from psychoanalysis, say, you know, what are the hidden psychological desires behind all this. Three more things then about cultural studies. It is a move towards then studying culture rather than society. Now, of course, culture tells us a lot about society, but the central, we begin with the cultural practices. And secondly, cultural studies, which was really properly invented in the 1960s in Britain, examines cultural practices in their relationship to power in society. That is to say, how is domination or rebellion incarnated in popular cultural forms? For example, it's fairly clear that if you love heavy metal, you will not learn about heavy metal in nursery school. You will not learn about it in primary school, and you will not learn about it in secondary school. So there's obviously something happening. There's obviously something happening here, and part of its attraction is an appropriation, the idea that it belongs to us and it does not belong to the school. And I think perhaps if you were taught heavy metal music in nursery school and in primary school, it would take away some of the attraction. Also, for example, one of the aspects of cultural studies is to look at how men and women are implicated differently in cultural practices. So you may have noticed, if you look at rock, you know, whether it be the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Dire Straits, Arctic Monkeys, etc., what do you notice about the women there? What women? There's a very clear absence of women, even in more recent decades. And this is fascinating because if you go on the Paris Metro these days, 20% of the drivers are women, and yet even today, 20% of guitarists are not women. So there's something particularly difficult. And all of this can be analysed. Yeah, I'm not giving you the answer. There have been books written on it like this. And finally, then, cultural studies at the outset, at the beginning, was progressive, radical, or political. There was an idea that studying popular culture means we think ordinary people are important. So that's obviously, in some ways, oppositional with it, because I don't think it's controversial to say that society is structured so that ordinary people are not very important. And so this idea, you know, let's study what ordinary people do with their lives, that had a certain radical aspect. But I deliberately put at the outset, because later on, some cultural studies today can be very, very abstract and it's difficult to see what is radical about it. So what are the origins of cultural studies in Britain? Well, it all starts in 1964. The Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies is established in Birmingham, in the University of Birmingham, in 1964. Now, first of all, why the University of Birmingham? It's not an accident that this is not the University of Oxford, this is not the University of Cambridge, and this is not a university in London. Yeah, so it's not marginal, but provincial and outside the centres of academic power, where the new ideas come from. And they established a magazine. This is what you do if you're establishing an area of study at universities. You must establish a review. For example, in France, over the last 10 years, we have established a volume, which is the university study of popular music in France. So they established working papers in cultural studies in 1972. The big names which were associated with the first few years: Richard Hoggarts, Raymond Williams, E.P. Thompson, and Stuart Hall. These are the four. Again, you notice how many women? No women at all there. This will come later. So who are these people? Well, I will be looking at some of them. The one that I won't be looking at later is E.P. Thompson. E.P. Thompson, then Marxist historian, who most famously wrote a book, The Making of the English Working Class, which talked about how the working class in history does not appear, but it makes itself. It's this idea of a social group making itself. All of them studied the role of popular culture in class-based society in England. So let's have a look at a few of them. Richard Hoggarts and Raymond Williams. It's not surprising that they appeared in the 1960s, because in the 1930s, universities were still only for the elites. The number of university students in Britain goes like this: 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. It goes up after the Second World War, partly because of the needs of industry getting more sophisticated, and so on. So what did these people say, Richard Hoggarts and Raymond Williams? Well, first of all, they tended to see that the culture of common people, working class culture, is more authentic than middle and upper class culture. I'm not saying that's my opinion, that's their opinion. More authentic, this is one of these words which is difficult to get your head around, authentic. Because they said that working class culture derives from experience. You still see this idea today. If you listen to somebody talking about on the radio or on the television about why rap is important, they'll say, it's because it comes from people's real lives. And so many people will say rap is more important than opera, because opera today does not come from people's real lives. So this is one criteria you can use. Does it come from people's real lives? Now, this can be rather difficult, because it's difficult to prove that something comes from people's real lives. And as you know, there are many white sons of rich parents who love gangster rap, because psychology is complicated. So the first thing they said is that they valorized working class culture. So they were really fighting a battle, because this is a time when the BBC and the establishment said, oh yes sir, of course, the only important culture is high culture. Yeah, opera, classical music, theatre, and so on, and television, and that's okay for the working class, but it has no value. And so this is the second part, that these two people said they were against canonical elitism, that is to say, the idea that only the canon, only the greats are great, you know. You're young French people, so you should be reading Corneille every night, who's his friend? Thank you, Racine, yes. I don't know if they were really friends. Yes, that these are the greats. And of course, if you want to waste your time watching television, well, okay, but as soon as you can, get back to reading Zola and Victor Hugo and so on, that idea. At the same time, they made a distinction between working class culture and mass culture. Mass culture, the idea, difficult to define, but the idea of often Americanized commercial culture, colonizing working class culture, and we will see a little bit more of this in a moment. Here is the big book which Richard Hoggarts came out with, and you can see here on the right one of the earlier editions, and you can see it was very popular because it's a pelican, I'll leave it to Posh, a pelican book, and he chose, not surprisingly, a painting by? Lowry. Thank you, Lowry. Yes, a painting by Lowry. Yeah, it's very. You can see the forms of their things, and on the left you can see a modern edition. Then the uses of literary aspects of working class life, and there they are, young people reading comics. They're reading comics. Yeah. So this is the idea here, that there are things to say about this. So that's Richard Hoggart. If you ever do any work on cultural studies, this is the one you have to read it first, because it's obligatory. So what does Hoggart say? Hoggart regrets what he sees as the breakup of the old class culture. He laments the loss of the close-knit communities and their replacement by the emerging manufactured mass culture. Now again, I'm not saying that this is not my opinion, this is his opinion. So this is an idea. This is an idea you don't see so much anymore because it's such a long way away. But certainly, my grandparents, they lived in the same part of town all their lives, and their sister lived across the road, very close communities, with all the advantages and disadvantages of that. But Hoggart, in any case, regretted all these things, and he said the problem was manufactured mass cultures such as tabloid newspapers, advertising, and Hollywood are taking over the original cultures. So these are very very common ideas you see. These alien phenomena, he believes, has colonized local communities and robbed them of their distinctive features. We all sometimes have impressions like this. If you go to a small town in the south of France, and you say, "Oh, the shops are exactly the same as in Rouen, exactly the same shops." You get this impression that there's a sort of uniformizing thing going on, that the distinctive characteristics are being lost. So he wrote The Uses of Literacy in 1957, and it can be considered as a programmatic work. Parts of it are written as a manifesto. So what does he say that intellectuals should be doing? He said that a critical reading of art needs to reveal the felt quality of life of a society. That art should capture the experience of the everyday as unique. That's very difficult things to define. The felt quality of life, the structures of feeling. It should communicate how groups of people feel about their own lives. That's what he thinks is the best thing for art to do. So notice this is a very collective view of art. Some people think that the artist should show their psychological structure of the individual. I need to show what is going on in my head. But it can be considered that what is important is to show what is going on for people in general. And here are a series then of books by Raymond Williams: Culture and Society, 1958; Reading and Criticism, 1950; The Country and the City, 1973. A few interesting things about this. First of all, you can see his first book in 1950 was Reading and Criticism. So he began with literary criticism. He began with literature. And then, in fact, one of the things he is doing is he's saying that what people do in society can be analysed in some ways in the same, using the same tools as we use to analyse literature. That is to say that if you look at, well, I'll show you in a moment some examples with clothes, that they different kinds of clothes symbolise different things. They can be metaphors. We playing roles, just like the author pretends to be the narrator. In other cultural practices, like karaoke, we're playing a role of being somebody else, and so on. This one is quite interesting. The Country and the City, 1973. It's a history of how people have thought about the country and the city, what image we have of the country. Now, maybe some of you live in the country. I usually explain this class to people in Paris. It's easier. I lived in the country for a few years in Agen, and people in the country never go to the country. When you see people say, I must go to the country, the people who live in the city, and they go to the country on holiday. But where we lived, it was 5 minutes from the country walking. And we never went there because people don't go there when they live there. That's just my own little thought on the country and the city. So, Raymond Williams was more specifically, more so than Richard Hoggart, came from a Marxist tradition. and he suggested that culture was the expression of organic communities resisting determinism, so resisting fate, resisting just doing what they were told to do in society. And he, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, he had a very wide view of culture. He thought of culture as material, you know, whether it's companies or banks or trade unions or nightclubs, ways of organizing activity, also intellectual and spiritual. And he took this idea from Karl Marx's idea of base and superstructure. And base and superstructure is a very simple idea. It simply says that if you want to understand a society, if you want to understand a society or a period, a historical period, you need to first of all look at materialism. How do people make enough money to eat? Yeah. Where do the tables come from? Where do their clothes come from? Do they make their own clothes? Do they buy clothes? Who makes the clothes if they buy the clothes? This is materialism. This is the idea of the base. And according to Karl Marx, the big changes in society, war, famine, industrial revolutions, happen because of the different ways people produce things. And other ideas like political parties, the family, they come out of the base. They're slightly independent, but the big changes are caused by the material life of people. That's the Marxist idea. And this is what Raymond Williams followed. He also talked about the importance of texts which capture the structure of feeling of everyday life. But he also talks about something else in the last bit here. He talks about dominant, residual, and emergent ideologies and cultural forms. So a dominant idea is one that is, what is dominant, is that most people believe. For example, in general, we believe that if you switch on the television at 8 o'clock, you will receive the news, and that the news is the most important things which have happened in the last day or two. That's what we generally believe. Even if we sometimes we say we don't believe it, but we still, you know, we kind of half believe it. We don't completely believe it. But, you know, whereas news is a new invention. It's about 150 years old. Because, of course, you know, it's... if you just look at the news, you know, if the Queen dies tomorrow, this will be news. But if Mrs. Dupont, who lives just over there, dies tomorrow, this will not be news. So it's very constructed. The news is extremely constructed. So that's a dominant idea. A residual idea is an idea which came from a past society and is just surviving today. Really, it was created for a past society. For example, the monarchy. The monarchy was invented for another form of society in the past, where the most important thing was your blood. You have superior blood or inferior blood. And so today, the monarchy and all the festivals and things about the monarchy are what he would call a residual cultural phenomenon. And finally, emergent cultural phenomenon and ideologies are ones which give us a glimpse of what is possible in the future. And now, of course, that's a matter of opinion, what is emergent, but people might consider some forms of feminist art or community control over art to be symbols of what is possible in the future. This is the Raymond Williams thing. And I'm just going to stop right now for 5 minutes break.